Welcome among
the Rollist.
The Rollist podcast is an opportunistic show. I take opportunities of people visiting London, and today I'm taking advantage of a slightly quieter than usual Chaosium meetup here at Dark Sphere, where I found
David Scott
and Ian Cooper.
Could you introduce yourself to the listeners of the Rollist podcast?
I'm David Scott. I am Chaosium's UK and European events coordinator and digital support.
And I'm Ian Cooper, and I am the line editor for the HeroQuest / Questworlds line at Chaosium.
We got a couple traditional questions in the Rollist. The first one is, how would you explain, describe what is a tabletop role-playing game to someone who never witnessed or have any clue about what it is?
I think the best description would be it's just an extension of sitting around a campfire from 10,000 years ago and telling cooperative stories with your friends.
You might say that's something as old as Bronze Age then.
Older.
Ian?
My daughter is 6 and we do role-playing games all the time. So we sit around in her bedroom and dolls and her stuffies are all given roles in whatever show she finds particularly interesting, like Teen Titans or Ninjago, and we act out stories, and those stuffies, etc., actually are characters and they do things in those stories, often comical because she is 6. And in a way, role-playing games are no different. We're just slightly more constrained. We have slightly more rules to play with to keep us on a kind of agreed path together. But it's really no different to that kind of let's pretend game that you play as when you're a kid.
So when would you say, maybe you were not 6, but when was the first time you were exposed to this more structured way of doing pretend?
My first role-playing game experience, I must have been about, I think, 12. We got Traveller because we were science fiction fans, and we rolled up characters, which was very exciting and promised a lot to us, and then we had no idea what to do with the game. And then probably about 6 months later, one of the older boys at the school showed us Dungeons & Dragons, and that was much clearer because you went into the dungeon and you killed monsters, and so we played Dungeons & Dragons for quite a while before we figured out later on how to play Traveller.
What about you, David?
My first experience was really at secondary school, where we had a war games club. Role-playing games hadn't really come out fully yet in the form that we know nowadays. And we had a teacher called Cozy Powell. It wasn't his real name. He was Bob Powell. And he was one of these war gamers who wanted to take war games a bit further. So his games were in-house massive campaigns where, for example, we each had an African country and we played the leaders in a massive continent-wide war game, but we would have meetings and actually have to play out who we were. Although we played the real African leaders, I, of course, was Idi Amin. But he also introduced the idea of more interactive wargaming. So he had a game of knights where we would duel each other and, you know, take wounds and things, much like you would in a role-playing game as opposed to a traditional war game.
So those were for both of these house rules, or diplomacy, or chainmails?
All house rules. There was no role-playing game around at that time. It wasn't until a year later that we got a copy of D&D, and then that was the beginning of the end.
Were you dabbling with house rules as well?
No, I think by the time that I came around, we were close to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. OD&D was kind of a memory, and so AD&D was complete enough for us. In fact, we dropped a lot of rules. Although, to be fair, there were some house rules. So we had a teacher, Joe Warrior, who we used to play with, who persuaded us, because he was a teacher, that he was the master of all the rules, until I began to read the rules more carefully and realise some of the ways he said the rules worked didn't really work. A particular one I always remember was that lightning bolt in D&D, he treated as a point attack. You attack one enemy with it. But in fact, it's an area effect attack, and it bounces down the corridor, zapping things. So, of course, we always had Fireball, because a lightning bolt, by comparison, was not very good. And then you read how lightning bolt is supposed to work, bouncing down the corridor between enemies, and you think, I'd have just taken lightning bolt every time if I'd known the truth. But that was quite a telling lesson for me, that point you reach as a child when you suddenly realise the adults are making it up.
Over time, I found out that even when I was mastering, I was mastering what had been mastered to me before and never read as thoroughly as I should the rules. I just applied what I remembered from previous sessions with different game masters.
I think the only danger was that a few of us, not me actually that much, but a few people then became rules lawyerish, and we deteriorated from what had been essentially a model of rulings that Joe had been making, which I now think is a kind of superior model, into slavish devotion to the rules. The problem with that is that, you know, mid-game we would spend 10 minutes looking up rules, fighting over the interpretation, rather than actually continuing with the given combat, but with a DM making a spot ruling. And I used to say at the time that I think a lot of the value of modules for us then, we played a lot of modules, that was because you didn't trust the other guy. Whereas the modules came from TSR, you could trust them to be fair and balanced, provided the GM ran them in the, you know, as written, that was okay. We had a strong prohibition against DMs making stuff up that wasn't in actually the module, because they were probably rubbish at it, and therefore that was cheating, right? So they had to play fair by the rules of the module as written. We got over that. But
you're nodding your head a lot. Are you nodding your head as a culprit of rules lawyering or as a victim?
It was probably the opposite for us, in that we played lots of open-ended games. And I'll be absolutely honest, between the ages of 13 and probably 17, 18, we weren't role-playing games. We were playing mechanized killing, fighting games that were little more than war games masquerading as role-playing games. D&D was really hack and slash with little actual role. You know, you are the fighter. You are effectively what Munchkin parodied.
So you were first-person wargaming?
Yeah. Effectively, I think it was first-person wargaming.
I mean, I think that's true of us. But I think, interesting, bringing it back to our connection here, it was a RuneQuest and Call of Cthulhu that changed that for us. When we moved away from D&D, we literally, you just played your role in the party, to suddenly in RuneQuest having a cult which essentially gave you a moral code, an idea of what your character might believe or want to do about things in a way that Alignment never had for us, and actually meant that people began to make decisions based on what they felt their character would do as a Yamalian or a Humacti. And then later on, we got to Call of Cthulhu, where really, you know, bereft of classes or cults or anything, you're playing ordinary people, and where the sanity rules kind of made you make more realistic decisions. I'm frightened of no scary things that go bump in the dark and stuff. That was really where we entered role-playing. D&D, I agree with you, had never really been role-playing for us.
you bring up Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, we are at a official Chaosium event. Do the two of you remember when and how you were first exposed to the work of Chaosium?
Mine was a very strange tale of, to cut a long story short, when I was about 13 or 14, I fell in with some university students who were easily 5 to 6 years older than me, one who worked at Games Workshop. And I used to go and play with them in the school holidays. And the guy who was running Traveller, a guy called Andy Slack, was really sick with flu. And he said, "Go upstairs, I can't run a game." And I fell straight into this game that I had no idea about. And I was a guard on a caravan.
Was it in a dorm or...?
Yeah, in a dorm, in a shared house in Reading. And then we were guards on a merchant convoy, which was like, well, you know, this is outside. This is not D&D. You know, where's the dungeon? And he said, "Oh, when you're suddenly attacked by trolls, what do you do?" And it was really a case of, well, I just... No, you can do what you want. He said, "Well, what would you do in real life?" And I said, "Well, I'm the caravan guard. I'll rugby tackle the troll coming towards me." And we rolled some dice, and I, on my first ever roll, I fumbled in the BRP game system, the worst possible thing you can do. And there's a fantastic table of results, and it was hit nearest object, do maximum damage to your head.
Wow.
Roll for the location, head. And my first rolls in the game were I had dived for a troll and rugby tackled a tree and knocked myself out. And I went back to school saying, "You'll never guess, I've played the best game in the world." And of course, the nature of RuneQuest combat is that for the next hour and a half, I sat there with my character unconscious and did nothing but watched the rest of the game, where rather than having the strange mechanical attack system of D&D, it was a to and fro of combat and shields and donkeys being attacked and people running away. And it was amazing. I went back to school with a copy of the book, and the rest of my group were entirely dismissive of it because it wasn't real role-playing. It was not Dungeons & Dragons, and secretly what happened was it was taking people away from the D&D campaigns.
It's funny because I guess it's this story going full circle, but when I started in the late 90s, or at least when and where I started, the listeners are so bored of me saying that because I repeat so many times. Dungeons & Dragons, it was in the lull between the end of TSR and the beginning of Wizards. And Dungeons & Dragons was like maybe the fifth or sixth most played game. So we didn't have that. But now when I try to encourage people to play more games, you got this massive D&D community, which is very passionate but very difficult to get out. Even if what they're doing is not this first-person wargaming, they're still very adamant to stick with Dungeons & Dragons. So, sorry, I keep rambling with that aspect of the community nowadays.
But this is an interesting point about the Dungeons & Dragons community. From my experience, is it's very hard to get people out of it because it's a very comfortable thing to play.
I think there's even mechanic aspect to it. I find the leveling, because I was asking a couple people recently about them playing D&D rather than these other games, and the answer which came was not, "I prefer Dungeons & Dragons," or "I prefer the Game Master," or "I'm busy with this adventure." It was often, "Yeah, but I really want to reach level 7. And it's kind of the same thing with, you know, smartphone games or massively multiplying role-playing games. You've got this mechanic of, it rewards playing more the game, not just the experience you go through with the game.
The way I got out of Dungeons & Dragons was very straightforward. When I moved to London, I couldn't find anybody to play anything but Dungeons & Dragons. And through a series of happy events, I met two other guys who didn't want to play Dungeons & Dragons. And 34 years ago, we started a club.
Okay, straightforward.
And the rule was no Dungeons & Dragons.
What club is that?
This is the Tuesday Nights that meets in West London and has done for 34 years.
Oh, yeah. I should add it to my article about recommended clubs.
The Tuesday Nights is a very important part of the new Chaosium story, because many members of Chaosium have passed through it.
Okay.
So Rick Mintz, who was one of the founders of Moon Design, with Colin Phillips, who was the other founder, Colin set the game club up with me. And it's Moon Design that then went on to become the new Chaosium. So it's sort of gone full circle. And we're still there. And the best thing about it is we do allow some D&D now, is that every 6 weeks we play a different game. So I would actually say one of the greatest things about role-playing games is that you can play so many different things. At the moment, I'm playing Legend of the Five Rings.
I love that game.
There's another group playing Numenera. There's another group who are doing one nights of board games and escape rooms. And then in a few weeks' time, we'll change again. And I think it's a really good thing for any role player to play a wide variety of games just for the experience.
To have this curiosity.
Yeah. And it's fun.
What about you? Oh, were you first exposed to Chaosium?
I remember in White Dwarf, they had a reviews section. And I remember reading a review for Ballastor's Barracks. And I was quite taken by the imagery in the review of this idea that there was this city in the kind of semi-arid desert where this moon-worshipping empire had arrived and were keen to marry basically their goddess to the god of the city, Pavis, and this axe they were seeking would be the symbol of that marriage. And it was like one of the most intriguing, most sword and sorcery-like ideas that I'd seen, as opposed to the sort of pseudo-medieval fantasy of D&D. But I kind of didn't seem to go much further than that. And then I was looking for a D&D module in the local, back in the days when toy shops stocked game, and I came across a book called Cults of Prax. And I thought, oh, and I flicked through it, and it seemed like it was religions of fantasy games. And I kind of had this memory of the Ballastor's Barracks review, thinking, now that could be quite a cool setting. So I bought it to use my D&D game. And I read through Cults of Prax, and I was particularly taken with the narrative. So those who've never seen it, the book is about, I don't know, 13 cults? Cults of the religions that people worship. And it's how at least a proportion of people in Glorantha the setting and get magic, and you have different levels like initiates and room levels, and it gave you what you get access to at each kind of like different level of a cult. But also it talks about the cult and its values and its mythic history, that kind of thing. But what really struck me was they had a narrative of a merchant, Biturian Varosh, as kind of examples. And they had these running examples of his adventures using the magic from these different cults or encountering members of these different cults. And that really kind of, it was the first real, I think, probably in-game fiction I'd read and really captured in setting. Also didn't really understand all the detail of all the rules and stuff, so I thought, well, to really make use of this in my D&D campaign, I better go and get the RuneQuest rulebook so I can understand how it works. So then I bought RuneQuest, and then I was intrigued by the system, right? No character classes, armor doesn't make you harder to hit, it absorbs damage that you take. And again, this saga of Runespear, who was the example character, really brought this world to life with it. And much more than D&D, at the time there was like a setting Greyhawk, but it was very poorly fleshed out. It actually told me what this setting was like, gave me a feel for it and how you might play it. So I kind of rushed back and said, I want to play RuneQuest to everyone at the school club. And we played it. A bit like David, you know, we found traditionally someone died in about their first 5 minutes of the game. But people loved it. People loved actually the slight thrill of when you roll the dice in combat, are you going to live? And some of the campaigns, like Borderlands, that we then began to play, taught us quite a lot about and Griffin Mountain, different ways to play that weren't just dungeon crawls. And then later from that, we got into Call of Cthulhu. And I'd actually say probably when I was at school, we played more Call of Cthulhu during the lunch breaks and more RuneQuest in the holidays, because Cthulhu, you could make quite a lot of progress investigating stuff in a lunch break and move on. But loved Cthulhu. In fact, I was a bit of a scaredy cat, and I used to get scared by Doctor Who and Sapphire and Steel, which is a UK show some of your listeners may have seen. I used to get scared reading Lovecraft stories. I used to have nightmares about them. But I actually found it quite a powerful game for that reason, because it was still... I miss being scared, by the way, by horror. I'm not saying that negatively. I miss horror scaring me, because that's his point.
It's difficult to be emotionally available and also have the time availability to be scared again by a role-playing game, I find.
Yeah. I mean, we pretty much played a lot of Chaosium games and then Traveller as well. I ran a lot of Traveller, and then there was one point, Traveller 2300. But we'd really play much D&D. D&D had really fallen from favours. And the thing is, though, I don't have any particular problem with D&D, and I think I understand D&D in a way, what its attraction is to some people, which is they like being more constrained. So if I'm playing the cleric or the rogue or the fighter, I know what my role is in the party. And there are some people, definitely, you see them come to a role-playing game, and as we were talking earlier, for them, they want to participate, they want to roll some dice, they want to use their abilities, they want to do stuff, and they want to have a quite narrow set of options so they can master that and then react. The difficulty with more open-ended games, the basic role-playing family system, or even more so the games I currently work on at HeroQuest and Questworld, the more open you make it, the more it's, what do you want to do? The system will adjudicate that for you. Some people, I think, find that more difficult because given the choice to do anything, people can be paralyzed by that. They'd rather be narrowed down towards doing something.
Today you mastered a game, and David, as a player of that game, we actually had a lot of options, and the system was involved, but not as involved as it would have been for something like Dungeons & Dragons, even if it was the same story.
Yeah, so HeroQuest Grantha, which is, we're kind of renaming the engine to be Questworlds behind it. It's a one mechanic system, right? It's essentially opposed D20s, and you either roll once to sum up the entirety of what it is, the fight or the attempt to sneak into the temple and steal the golden idol, or you can debate a series of rolls. You want to break down into detail of each sword stroke, of each lock that you need to pick. We tend to a lot favor the first one because you move really fast, you can tell a lot of story, by playing only for 2 or 3 hours. And as I get older, I don't have the school holidays and the weekends to play anymore, so I like the speed of being able to tell a story fast. It's an engine which has a simple mechanic, and then the GM makes a lot of rulings. How can we interpret this mechanic to cover what you want to do? And once the players get used to the fact they can pretty much do anything, and they just ask how to do something, and we figure out between us how to rule that be possible within the game mechanic, it's enormous flexibility for the players. And you see, you have a light bulb moment when the light bulb goes off and they can figure out what they can do. And I can remember a fellow podcaster of yours, Dirk the Dice, from the Grognar Files, playing HeroQuest, I think, for one of the first times he played it. And he was being attacked by a spirit, and he had an iron dagger. And he said, well, can I stab the spirit with my iron dagger? And I said to him, well, yes, you can. You will definitely damage it, but it's insubstantial, so the dagger will also strike you. And he said, I do it. I stab the spirit and myself with a dagger at the same time, and I keep stabbing until it's dead. Now, a couple of important things to understand there. One is, that's very hard to simulate in a lot of games, but an engine that's very abstract like HeroQuest lets you simply say, okay, what would that take? Some kind of toughness is more what's at stake here, right? I can keep stabbing. The other thing is, whereas a game like RuneQuest is quite strict about how can I combat a spirit, that kind of thing, we're prepared to be much more freeform of our interpretation of Garantha, provided we feel we're telling a cool story, right? And he had basically iron, it's a Bronze Age setting, which is a magical metal. My attitude was, if you're going to stab yourself with an iron dagger, of course you'll damage the spirit that's attacking you. And so that's more the spirit of that game, which some folks adore. Some folks, it's too free. They want more constraint.
At Chaosium, in the world of Glorantha, you can have it both ways if you want, because you've got RuneQuest and Glorantha system. Am I right?
So we have three systems.
Three systems.
Which is complicated things. So it's all the same setting, which is the important part.
Which is
Glorantha. Greg Stafford's imaginary world of Glorantha. Greg originally started writing about the world in the 60s, long before games even started. And his first foray into making it into a game, that were war games. He brought out a game called Dragon Pass.
So Glorantha was a war game before being a role-playing game.
A classic hex and counter game of magical empires fighting the hero wars. And it was only later, in the late 70s, it became an actual role-playing game, RuneQuest, in 1978. But we have three strands to our bow. We have RuneQuest Glorantha, which is basically an upgrade of RuneQuest 2, which was our main RuneQuest from years ago.
That's BRP?
Yeah, it's BRP-based, which is the percentile system. If you've played one BRP game, you can play any other, basically, with little...
Call of Cthulhu, Nephilim...
All of those. We have HeroQuest, which is written by Robin Laws originally, which is this narrative system of to and fro, and much more storytelling-based. And then we have a third strand, which is an unusual one, considering what we've been talking about, which is 13th Age Glorantha.
Oh, okay.
Because Jonathan Tweet and Rob Hinesu, who produced 13th Age, were big Glorantha fans. At one point, Rob Hinesu was an editor, working for Isseries, editing some of our products. And being great fans, they wanted to do a 13th Age version of Glorantha. And so there was a Kickstarter. So we actually have a core book in which you can play 13th Age. For those of you who are not familiar with 13th Age, it's another flavour of D&D.
We had a couple episodes where we had an actual player of 13th Age. I'm not sure it's the best to show the rules, but it's pretty much 3.5 of D&D 4
bis
of thing.
It's not as popular as D&D, but if you want to get into playing a Glorantha background, the source book is there. It's as simple as that.
The two of you now work for Chaosium, so what was your journey from being a player of Chaosium game to being an actual full-time employee of Chaosium?
I'm not a full-time employee, I'm part-time, but that's enough. It's probably difficult to say because I first met Greg Stafford years ago when I was at school, effectively, just as I left school, I think, in 82. And then, through playing RuneQuest and other Chaosium games, there became a kind of addiction. Once you played one BRP game, you bought the next. So I remember when Call of Cthulhu came out, it was just like, wow, what's this? Who's H.P. Lovecraft? So you get into that. And then there were the other games that they did, Stormbringer, based on Michael Moorcock's world. We even played ElfQuest, Superworld. You name it, we kind of played it. But for me, it all kind of culminated in the 1990s when I became involved in running a convention called Convulsion, in which we invited the Chaosium crew to come over to the UK and be our guests of honour.
Nice.
And the committee that were involved in that later became the core of Moon Design, who later became the new Chaosium that took over about 5 years ago. And so I went from kind of being an outside person with a group associated with it to suddenly having my friends run the company. And it was just a kind of natural progression to end up working and doing the conventions and stuff, because that's what I did with them previously.
Reminds me of the story of quite a few people who has been interviewed by Derek the Dye from the Grognard Fight, of being co-opted by being this tight community of friends, and they work at Games Workshop, and then they end up being...
And the gaming industry in the UK, at least, is not huge. I think there's a very funny perception of the games industry being that a games company is hundreds of people stuck in rooms producing thousands of sheets of paper every week. And the reality is that a lot of the companies I'm aware of are just a few people doing their own thing that interests them. And we know most of them. In the relationship being they've, in my respect, they've either been guests at conventions I've run or have worked on products that I've been involved with, or some other connection. They're artists who've done one thing and not another. A lot of people in the gaming industry have many strings to their bow. So, for example, Jason Durrell is an example. He is a line editor for RuneQuest, Garantha. He's also the line editor for Conan, for Modiphius.
Oh, yeah. And you work for Modiphius as well.
And I've done some IT work for Modiphius, not in a creative role, but sadly in a real-world job role. So we are all kind of the same people in some respects, and most people are friends with at least some other people from other companies. I think if you did that 6 degrees of connection thing in the UK games industry, it would be very easy to get from one person to another.
Yeah, and how did you become an employed friend?
Like David, it's a side hustle for me, so there are very few actual full-time employees in the whole of the role-playing games industry. I was a member of a mailing list called the Garantha Digest, which was very famous in the kind of 90s for being really when Avalon Hill pretty much stopped publishing RuneQuest, where the fans continued to talk about Garantha and the setting, etc. And in the early part of the 21st century, Greg decided to produce a new game, Hero Wars, based, as we were saying earlier, on Robin Law's storytelling engine, and has antecedents in Greg's past in things like Prince Valiant, in a way. And the game came out. I met a few people that we started playing, actually, at Finchley Games Club originally. We were writing material for it, and they were looking for writers to basically start working on some of the supplements for the game line. I actually didn't really even put myself forward, but somebody else in the community, a writer called John Hughes, was working on some stuff for them, put me forward and said, you should write something, after some conversations we'd had. So I wrote a scenario for a book called Barbarian Adventures, and the scenario was called Blood Feud, and then began to write more. And I fell in with a couple of other fans, Mark Gagliotti and Simon Bray, who are running a company called Unspoken Word, and I did some work for them, and they published a couple of books I did exploring as kind of fan material, some of the areas that basically were not explored in official publications. And that led me deeper into writing for Isseries and then Moon Design when they took over publishing. And then really I fell in with Jeff Richards for that, Creative Director at Chaosium. And I'd always had this vision of wanting to put together a campaign pack that would be the kind of Sartreite campaign that many of us have played, where you play members of a clan struggling to survive lunar occupation. And I felt there's quite a lot of work sometimes needed for that. Not everyone had the time to do that. It wouldn't be nice if you could just pick that up off the shelf and start running the classic game we were all playing. So I put it together with Jeff's help. That's The Coming Storm, and it's a campaign, something with the 11 Lights. And then when Moon Design became Chaosium, Jeff had a lot of other work to take on, including looking at the new RuneQuest game. He said to me, someone needs to look after the HeroQuest line. I haven't got the time. Would you step into the shoes and do that? So we've been working on that since, and we're now trying to work on a new version of the generic games, taking the engine outside of Garantha. Well, it was always HeroQuest and HeroQuest Garantha. HeroQuest was the generic version. But branding-wise, I think we never really properly separated it from Garantha. So we're going to separate HeroQuest Garantha, which is our Garantha version of the engine, from Quest Worlds, the generic version of the engine. We're going to get out a system reference document so that you can essentially use our rules in your own game, similar to the way Fate or Blades in the Dark work.
So you could take a completely new concept or setting, do a cyberpunk request game, for
just
instance.
So we can, you know, make that engine with which we are in love with available to a lot more people to use to write games with, and then we'll produce some generic setting material to go with it, and we're focusing on that a little bit at the minute, and then we will also try and get out a bit more a steady drumbeat of some HeroQuest grant to material to go alongside it for the fans of that.
Any projects yourself you're working on?
My main thrust at the moment is to attract new players to our games. We have a kind of strange built-in obsolescence with the current gaming community as we're all getting older. So we need to introduce more people to it, and that's why these current Chaosium days at Dark Sphere in West London have started. Really run demonstration games to get new people in who've never experienced these games. So at the moment, my core kind of group are kind of the under 25s, the people who haven't played RuneQuest or Pendragon or Seventh Sea or HeroQuest Glorantha before, and just get them interested in something different. The venue we're at currently is hosting an enormous tabletop miniatures tournament.
It's gigantic.
Yeah, there's probably, 50 people here playing tabletop games with scenery and all kinds of stuff. And, of course, the owner wants to do a bit of diversification. And he likes role-playing games. Some of the people here like to play Call of Cthulhu. There's a growing D&D scene here. There's a big collectible card scene as well. But like all retail places, you can't just keep doing the same thing again and again. So I'm in on their wave of diversification.
As you were talking about the younger demographic, I just realized I've seen a lot of streams based on Call of Cthulhu or podcast. Recently, Critical Role played Call of Cthulhu. But I don't recall seeing any RuneQuest or Glorantha stream program.
Are you suggesting that as you sit opposite David and I with our Hollywood chiseled features and bodies that you're somewhat stunned that we haven't received a call yet to appear on streaming?
It's not really how it works, you know. I'm not exactly chiseled Hollywood, so I put on some wax this morning, but that's it.
So Cthulhu has some, so Mike Mason does quite a few there. I don't think we've ever really done anything for HeroQuest. I think Jason's done a few for RuneQuest, doesn't he, I think?
It's actually my intention to use the venue here. They're just sorting out their internals, but soon they'll be able to stream live any game that we want to from here.
Amazing.
it's a kind of, for me, it's a kind of strange thing watching people playing games. I'm from I wouldn't like to say an era, but I'm in my 50s now, and the internet didn't exist when I was younger, so there's a lot of things which I don't necessarily think about at all. They're just there. But the real turning point for me was that Mike Mason did a stream on Penny Arcade.
Oh, wow.
In which he played Call of Cthulhu 7. And I've been playing Call of Cthulhu for years, and we were still playing old editions. And I saw no reason why I should upgrade to the new rules, because a lot of companies put rules out and, you know, oh, here we are, another version of the same rules, you know. Games Workshop are very well known for this, or another edition of a certain army.
I mean, you mentioned Legend of the Five Rings. I was happy a while ago to find a copy of the French first edition.
Yeah.
Because that's the one I started with, and I was not keen on taking on the new one.
Yeah, we played first edition up until just a few years ago, and we're still on fourth. Why go to fifth when it works just as well? But having seen Mike do the Penny Arcade thing just out of interest, I was like, wow, I've missed out on something. And it was presented in such a way that I was suddenly like, oh, I can watch this. It's one of those things that you don't know is any good until you actually do it. And I've watched quite a few live streams, and I must say that it is a personality thing. I have watched quite a few and just gone, oh my God, if I was GMing that, those people are so annoying. You know, it's a kind of, they're almost actors being actors in some cases, but I have seen some really good authentic games that make me say, oh, I think I want to play that. So it certainly has a place, and it's something new to me.
I'm thinking, like, not exactly streaming, but podcast. One podcaster who I love, hello Joe, is the All We Roll podcast, and I believe he's got a somewhat close relationship to Chaosium, but he's been running Call of Cthulhu to death, and he's running a bit of Curse of Strahd, Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, but I haven't seen him run any RuneQuest or Glorantha. I mean, it might be a personal interest of him as a game master, but it's interesting to find. The place I hear the most about Glorantha and RuneQuest is the Grognard Files.
So I think there's a couple of things that you need to tackle, right? One is that Grognard's got a rich setting, so you'd have to figure out in a podcast how to avoid that being confusing, right? The second is that mechanically, it'd be interesting to understand quite how you portray something like RuneQuest, which has a very rich combat system, but you have to portray that in a way that wouldn't become dull. And that requires a little bit of post-processing, editing, all those kind of things, which makes it actually more of a deal than just, you know, a bunch of amateurs sitting around saying, you know what, we're going to record our game. To make that clear, you'd need some more elements of that. HeroQuest a little bit easier on the front of mechanically. It's very much, you know, such a simple system. But again, slightly suffers from the, you know, you've got to introduce the setting. So I think there's definitely things you could do, but I just don't know that necessarily something we've figured out quite how to tackle yet. The other thing is to bear in mind that, as David says, you know, I think some of it's about personalities of people that can carry that kind of presentation. And, you know, Mike does a great job for Cthulhu. Am I the person to do that for HeroQuest? I don't know that I am. So it's finding potentially the right people who would be, I don't know, the audience would warm to GMing and playing the game, and that they would feel they could see themselves in and see themselves playing the game in that place.
Well, I think in terms of streaming and podcasting content creation, it's not a top-down thing. Usually it's a bottom-up. Even, I mean, the most famous, obviously, Critical Role. It's not Wizards of the Coast, which decided, oh, let's round up a bunch of actors and have them play Dungeons & Dragons. They were players who happened to be actors who realized, well, we could record that, and they happened to know a channel which is Geek and Sundry, and then things happened. And most podcasters I know are not people who were authors or professionals working for a publishing company. Often they are individuals who are very passionate about a project, and that's the one they decide to play and record. I guess it says it goes a bit along the line of what you were saying about the RuneQuest community, which is slightly older than even the Call of Cthulhu community.
I think it may be, depending on the game, it's a number of things. It's also the material that's available. I mean, Call of Cthulhu is a fully rolling production line, new stuff coming out all the time. We had three new products in the last week or so come out. There's another big new bestiary coming out in a few months in the summer. We've just had the first drop of the first PDF adventure for RuneQuest. So we've had the core rulebook, bestiary, and a GM pack, which has three basic adventures that get you established. But we've only recently had another adventure pack come out, and that's what people really crave. Now, Ian talked a little bit about earlier that people want adventures to show how it's done officially. And although many people run their own sandbox long-term campaigns, myself included, a lot has to be said about running an established adventure. And Call of Cthulhu has the major advantage that it has a starter set. And the starter set's great because you can just sit down with a group of people and learn how to play the game on your own and then slowly build up and have a couple of friends and then play a big adventure. We don't yet have that for RuneQuest or our other product.
And RuneQuest, its selling point is kind of that it's very rich. So it's at the same time, it's very rich as a setting, but it's a bit awe-inspiring in terms of from which angle do you come into that?
Right. So, I mean, the big advantage Call of Cthulhu has there, right, is that essentially you are playing ordinary people. And the fact that you don't necessarily know anything about the Cthulhu mythos is probably an asset, not a loss, right? There's this horrible, mysterious thing happening to your character, and that's really part of the game. In a way, the more you know about Cthulhu, sometimes in a way you lose some of that. Whereas richer settings, definitely there is slightly more of a barrier to entry and working out how you get past that. Now, I think one of the key things that we try and emphasize a lot recently is there is no right way of doing it. And that if you played at the table with Greg, who created the world, you know, he would play very fast and loose with the details as it suited the story he was telling as a games master at the table. He was creating a session for his friends to enjoy, not a work of fiction to be glossed over later. So I think that's one of the things to emphasize. When you deal with a rich setting, is don't be overwhelmed. Just take the parts that you like and introduce those, introduce other elements slowly. So one of the things I've taken to doing a little bit, I run the 11 Lights, which is the campaign that comes to Coming Storm at the minute, at the Roleplay Haven in Archway. One of the things I've taken to doing is when at the beginning of the session, when everyone's settling in and the players are recounting what happened from their memory the last session, I sometimes then throw in a little bit of background, which I think is applicable to either this session or a couple of sessions coming up, to explain a little bit more detail. So the last session, I took 5 minutes out to run through a little bit and show some maps of the Cincina tribe's history with the Talmoria tribal werewolves. Quite what had happened, because some of the characters knew, or my characters boast of fear and hate werewolves, but why? So I ran through some of the backstory and history. And if you do like bite-sized pieces like that, which then become relevant in play in subsequent sessions, I think that's an easy way to gradually build the picture, rather than trying to say, I'm going to overwhelm you with all this detail you don't need to know. And one of the reasons that we know that's true is because to begin with, we had none of that detail. It's only accreted over time. When we started, there was RuneQuest and Cult of Prax, and we played quite happily. And then a new book came out, and we're kind of like, oh, look, more things to know about. And so I think people shouldn't be put off. They should. You can pick up the RuneQuest core rulebook or the HeroQuest core rulebook, the 13th Age core rulebook, and just play with that. And feel free. And don't worry that you may think, oh, surely there's some deep lore about this thing over here. Don't worry about it. Play your version, and then later on, if you want to, come back and figure that out.
When you were mentioning your very first session of RuneQuest, you were playing one of the guards of the caravan. This merchant on the caravan being a guard in a Bronze Age, Iron Age time would ignore 99.99999% of the information regarding the world in which he lives. He just knows, I'm a god, I got a spear, I got a job.
And so the demo games that we run here on our meetups are exactly the same. So if you come along and play the RuneQuest demo, which can last between 1 and 2 hours, the name of the game is called Jewel Heist, which says to everybody, we're going to go and steal something. And it's a jewel. And depending on how long you want the game to last or how many people you've got, you can start it in different places. And basically, the plot is really simple. You are told you have to go and steal something, and the reason is whatever. And it's dark, so you can't see anything, and you're off. And the adventure unfolds with very little need to know any of the background at all. Likewise, when we play Pendragon, it's a very simple introductory adventure in which you are practicing to be knights. You have a bit of sword play, you have a bit of jousting. So these are all things that people actually know already, or they've had their head in a bucket of sand for years. You understand intrinsically how knights work.
It's a big trope, and at the same time, oddly enough, it's not something which happened that often in other medieval fantasy games. You know,
So that's kind of interesting at that kind of level. For our Call of Cthulhu one, it's a little bit more complicated because we've got some set games which are demonstrations. But you get to play, and the main one we're running at the moment called Crimson Carnival, you get to play circus performers.
Nice.
In a circus to solve a mystery. And most people understand the concept of a circus, and most people understand the concept of a mystery, and we take it from there. You do not have to know under any circumstance any history or background details, because they're all barriers to you getting involved in a game. We've got, at the club I run, we have a kind of new group of people joining the game who are women. I would like to just say over 45. They form a particular sort of setup in that their kids have left home or gone to university. They're looking for things to do. They've discovered their mates play role-playing games, and they turn up and they just want to have fun. What we don't want to do with new players is suddenly start expecting them to have a history of one of the games we play is The Three Musketeers. You just have to have seen a film. You don't have to have a PhD in any of these backgrounds whatsoever. And these people turn up and just play and have fun. And as long as your games are set up to be an enjoyable experience for your players, that's it. I don't think any game at all should ever have an entry level that makes your players never want to come back again and play it as a one-off.
So we're talking a lot about bringing in new people, and you mentioned the Call of Cthulhu starter set. Are there starter sets in the pipeline for RuneQuest or HeroQuest? Making faces.
there's a RuneQuest one in the pipeline, but we're a small company, and I think the easiest way to put it is that this all takes time.
Yeah.
All of it takes time, and to be absolutely fair, the Cthulhu starter set has been a great success. It would be foolish not to imagine that we would do another one for another line.
Certainly with HeroQuest Caranthra, it's old school in the sense that it's only like 140, 160 odd pages. It's a very slim volume, and you can definitely get started with that. With Quest Worlds, what we intend to do is launch a line of what we call genre packs, which are basically a setting in about 30 pages, and go back much more to that kind of old school model of 30 pages will do you to pick up something. So we wouldn't specifically on that line have a starter set, because everything will probably be starter set, right? But yeah, I think all those things are valuable to help people get into gaming. And I think that we, as a sector and an industry, just need to avoid gatekeeping. We need to avoid telling people you can't play this because it's a rich setting and you don't understand all of it and that kind of thing, etc. It's just a tool, a setting, to use as part of having fun at the table. And you pull bits out of it to make fun, and there is no way of doing it wrong or right. And that's one of the key things to understand, I think.
It's a large buffet, and you put on your plate whatever you want to pick from the buffet.
Yeah, yeah. And in Pendragon, for example, which is set in the time of Arthurian knights, Greg Stafford based it on Malory's works. And, of course, there were no lady knights. And the question is, would you let women in your gaming group play women knights? And the answer is, yeah, of course. Why would you tell people they can't do something they want to in your game? I'm a firm believer in accommodating people in the way that they want to play. If you want to play something that wasn't particularly part of that genre, so for example, if you were playing a game of Arthurian knights and the person wanted to play, I don't know, a troll, I would probably say that's going to be a bit more complicated, but I might try and accommodate a troll knight for some reason from the land of fairy. I mean, I'm all for having a go at this. It shouldn't be to the detriment of your games, though. You can always say to your players, it's a great idea, but I think we might have to tone it down slightly. And I think one of the easiest ways to see is, have you seen Shrek?
Yeah, and one of the things that I'd say on that kind of score, I mean, what is the game about would be a question for me always. And Pendragon is a game about being a knight. Okay, and what that means in the sense of the Arthurian romance, what it means to be a knight. And so my attitude would be, if you want to play a female knight as opposed to a male knight, that's absolutely fine. To me, what the game is not about is that you are a female knight. It's just about that you are a knight. And the only reason I think I might warn a player off being a troll knight is I'd be saying to him, I don't want this game to be about you being a troll. So you can be a knight from some trollish background if you want, but that won't be the key to play. The key to play is about being a knight. And you may bring in and say, oh, well, I have a different view of this and that because of my trollish background, but it has to be about being a knight. And I think that's the key to avoid people derailing a game is what you want to do that's different, still in keeping with the focus of what the game is about, then we can do it. If it's going to derail it for you and the other players, maybe we should think again.
Recording for a while, so I think it's time for traditional closing question, which is an homage to another podcast called The Weekly Planet. And the question is, what are you reading? What are you gonna read? First of all, it doesn't have to be a role-playing book, and actually it doesn't even have to be a book. The question really is, what are you consuming in terms of content? Can be a movie, can be a video game, can be a comics. And what are you planning to consume in the near future? David, what are you reading at the moment?
I have just finished the Rivers of London book.
Why would you read that, I wonder?
The real reason I was reading it is that we are, of course, doing Ben's game, Rivers of London, and I'd never heard of him. And I thought, well, I might just look at this. And then I was like, why has nobody ever told me about this before? Because it's the kind of genre I really like. It's a police procedural with a bit of magic. I really like the Dresden Files. I like lots of TV with detective stuff in it. And this is just a kind of add on to, I don't know, a UK police procedural with weird stuff. I've just moved on to the comics that are in between the books. He did something very strange, which I wasn't aware of, in that between his novels, he released comics, which tell much shorter stories, but are part of the overall plot, so as to speak, which is great.
My own What Am I Reading actually is I'm in the middle of the second book, but in audio format with Audible, and the actor playing not only Peter Grant but all the other characters, including the women he will encounter, anyone really, he makes all the voice. The actor, I cannot remember his name, but he's magnificent. He's great. It brings really the book to life. So I recommend you check it out if you have an opportunity. Ian, what are you reading at the moment?
It's actually an interesting question to ask me right now. So I am reading a book called The Queen's Heir by John E. Boyle, which has an interesting history. Back in the early days of Hero Wars, they were trying to get a few more Glorantham pieces of fiction written. And it never really came to pass that it happened. But one of the novels was written by a guy called John E. Boyle. It says John E. and then a Boyle rather than Johnny. And John had written a novel, which there's an extract from in the original Hero Wars box set, which was set amongst the Maboda tribe who were wiped out by the Tel Mori. So it was very much related to the stuff I was doing with the Cincinna and the Rick and the Coming Storm. And he essentially ended up filing off the serial numbers to get out the door with this kind of pseudo-Babylonian Hittite namings that are thrown on top, which, if you read it as a Hittite or Babylonian kind of novel, you'd be like, the geography, the characters, the people, nothing makes any sense here. But what you can actually do is unpick it, go backwards and go, oh, he must mean this, or this bit's set in Prax, oh, I get that, right? So you can kind of, there's kind of a Glorantham novel, but it's not.
Are there Glorantham novels, official ones?
I think there's no actual official Glorantham novel out. There are novels that have been written, but nothing has ever been published. Greg did write some material. He never really necessarily completed any of his novels. There's lots of short stories.
So Chaosium did, in fact, produce the complete edition of Oliver Dickinson's Griselda series. Oliver Dickinson was, still is, a retired university professor specialising in the ancient world, and he wrote a series of novellas, I suppose, and short stories based around his heroine Griselda set out in Pavis, and these were compiled together into The Complete Griselda. So that did exist and still is available.
Yeah, we got that. And Penelope Love as well.
Yeah, Penelope Love wrote, I can't remember the name of the novel, but
it's Widow's Tale?
The Widow's Tale, which allegedly won an award for the world's worst fantasy sex scene. I can't remember the details as I've blotted that out. It was one of those like shimmering in the winds kind of lines. So there's a few odd bits and pieces around. That was published under license, but Oliver Dickinson is the only one who's been done officially through Chaosium.
I was double-checking, so the name of the actor who is the voice of the Moon of Urso and the Rivers of London novels is Cobna Oldbrook-Smith. So the Griselda books, would that be your What Are You Gonna Read?
My next on the list is I'm actually going to reread The Chronicles of Amber. I haven't read them for a long time, and then I was at a gaming convention which has quite a strong costume focus called Kraken, and Jason Darrell, the RuneQuest line editor, ran a game of Amber Diceless role-playing, which I very much enjoyed playing in, and it inspired me to go back, get a copy, and that's sitting by my bed waiting for that moment when I finally get around to reading the book, which I've got small children, so I get much less time to read than I used to, but that's next on my list.
My own What Am I Going to Read? Again, it's not a book. I caught on with my wife, who was watching on Netflix something called I Am Not Okay With This, which is a TV show with extremely talented actors and the direction and the photography and everything, which is sort of your classic contemporary mutant teenager, they get superpowers or they cannot control them and what is going on, but with really a focus on the mindset and the psychology of the main characters. And it's set in this kind of, is it today? Is it sort of the past? Maybe if you have seen It Follows. It Follows was sort of the near future, not quite set. I am not okay with this. It's kind of the opposite. It's like, it's today, but it feels a bit like it's the 80s at the same time, but not quite. Is it because it's a remote place in the US? But I really, really recommend to check that show. And actually, the main actress revealed on Twitter recently that she's a big fan of The Adventure Zone. So she's a fan of tabletop role-playing game, which doesn't hurt at all. David, your What Am I Gonna Read? And your closer, if you have one final thing to plug and your goodbyes.
I think I've got a pile of things to read, which I think everybody has a pile. I discovered I haven't read, there's a couple of books still left on the laundry files, which I really enjoyed.
You're really in that realm of contemporary occult.
It all just came together. It was all a bit Harry Potter, let's face it. I've also got to read the Expanse novels.
Oh.
A friend of mine who I put onto The Expanse, the TV series, then said, read the books, they're even better. So I've actually got the first one ready to go. And that's probably it.
Nothing else to plug?
We could be here for hours.
So, well, this is goodbye. Ian, anything else to plug?
Only really that, Watch This Space maybe by the time this podcast comes out, hopefully we'll have the Questworld's system reference document out and the new open gaming license version with that, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what people want to do with that.
Thank you, both of you. Thanks, listeners, for checking this episode. See you next month. I don't know what it's going to be about. Another opportunity being seized. And in the meantime,
have good games.
This episode included Ancient Land, The Holy Drug Couple by Homemade Lo-Fi Psych, To Be Free by Wild Leaves, High School Heroes by Flower Gang, No Knights in Armor by Firbin Tianu, and of course our theme song Solta of Rango by Bondedo Roll. All these songs are available via the Free Music Archive. The logo of the Rollist podcast is designed by Rolin Kunz, and you can find it on t-shirts, apparels, notebooks, stickers, and a number of things, including face masks, because that's a world we live in now. So, yeah, get yourself a fancy face mask with Computer Friend, the Baron of Munchausen, some Cat Tulu. I need to get myself one from the shop to have a look at what they look like, but they seem to look good and be of a good quality. We mentioned a lot of stuff in the episode this month, a lot of games by Chaosium and supplements, cool individuals to check out, some interesting RPG clubs. You can find them all in the description of this episode, so please go check it out. And if you click on the name of a tabletop role-playing game, chances are you're going to end up on Drive-Thru. And if you purchase that book, it will help a bit the show thanks to the Drive-Thru affiliate program. Now, by the way, I need to thank the people who did purchase stuff recently through this means that allow me to purchase a few games to investigate. Your support is very, very much appreciated. Please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcast. It's been a while since I last had a review, so I would be very thankful to get new ones. You can also support us via Patreon, and you get early access to the audio versions of our Café Rollist. I'm a bit behind with releasing them, but there's quite a few over there which have not been released on the regular feed. I don't know, maybe 6 episodes, maybe 8 episodes in advance compared to the regular feed. So yeah, there's good stuff over there. I'm a bit behind with reposting that everywhere because I've been actually recording quite a lot. A lot of that is on YouTube. I'm working on the game also. I'm busy with a lot of stuff lately. So if you want to keep track of all of that, the best way to do so is through joining the Rollist newsletter. It's only once per month, so you won't be cluttering your mailbox at all. And in there, you will have a list of absolutely everything I did within a month. Stuff like, very soon, let me check the date. Sadly, UK Games Expo was not happening this year. But like many conventions, we've got a little replacement. So yeah, it's on August 23rd through the 23rd. We're going to have Virtually Expo. And I'm going to have a panel there about tabletop role-playing games and Dungeons & Dragons explained to parents.
Don't miss that. It's going to be streamed. And I'm going to also run 4 sessions of Paris Gondo, the life-saving magic of inventorying. So if you want to try this game, you've got an opportunity to do so there. The sign-up is, I don't decide it, it's how it's organized, and they got loads of expenses, so they do need this little contribution. It's just £2 to sign up for a game. That's it. And it helps to pay for everything UK Games Expo, and we definitely want them to be back next year, so I suppose this money will go towards that. I will also be running a session at Nerd Burger Con. That one is on August 15th. Nerd Burger Con is organized by Craig Campbell, who was the guest of Café Rollist 117. That's one of those episodes you should be able to find on YouTube or on Patreon. They're not yet out there on the regular feed. What else? I don't know. Well, next month is going to be our 5th anniversary. I didn't get any question from anyone, but yeah, I need to record that episode. I'm not quite sure what it's going to be like yet. Yeah, I think it's going to be extracts of previous episodes and some fresh commentaries on them. We'll see. I hope you will be back. If this was the first time you listened to the show, please go check our archives and send me a little message on Twitter or somewhere to let me know what you think of the show. I hope you will be back next month. And in the meantime, have good games.
Alegria da moçada da perua favelada. Nosso som é fantasia pra mamãe, vovó, titia.
Rolê, rolê, rolê. Solta o frango e vem com a gente.
Rolê, rolê, rolê.
Solta o frango e vem com a gente.
Nós é tipo bem Jesus, todo mundo a gente ama. Ainda mais se for gatinha, rola até levar pra cama. A gente topa tudo, sapatão e bigoduto. Na hora do piriri, cai em mim outra travesti.
Vai, batuque!
Rolê, rolê, rolê.
Solta o frango e vem com a gente.
Rolê, rolê, rolê.
Red
Beard, do you think if I finish chipping this flint by time when sun is hottest, you could get it tied to a stick by a time when we all get hungry?
I don't think so, Bigfeet. You're forgetting, today we've all got to go to clearing where we go sometimes, from time when cricket shut up until time when we go back to our huts.
Really? What for?
It's Bronze Orientation Day.
Oh, bugger. I'm so sick of hearing about bronze. Bronze, 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 bronze. What's wrong with stone? Does stone not work all of a sudden?
Well, they say that bronze will revolutionise the way we hunter-gather.
Well, maybe, but I can't be doing with it. Horrid, shiny stuff. Blech.